I'm Chris Messini, and I'm joined in the studio today by the author and editor, Mary Norris. Mary began working as a proofreader and copy editor at The New Yorker in 1978, and over the next four decades helped set straight the grammar, punctuation, and usage of some of the country's most prominent writers. Her popular Comma Queen video series on thenewyorker.com offered entertaining and illuminating guidance to some of the English language's most troublesome topics, such as when to use further versus farther, and what pronouns to attribute to your pets. Her best-selling 2015 book, Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comma Queen, is part memoir and part style guide, mixing practical writing advice with humorous anecdotes from her life and long career. Mary's here in Spokane as part of the Eastern Washington University Visiting Writers Series. And Mary Norris, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Chris.
And also here with us is Rachel Torr, Professor of Creative Writing at Eastern Washington University. Rachel's a frequent contributor to the Spokesman Review, and her writing has also been published in the New York Times, the LA Times, Plowshares, and many other publications. She's the author of six books, including most recently Write Your Way In, Crafting an Unforgettable College Admissions Essays, and Misunderstood, Why the Humble Rat May Be Your Best Pet Ever. Rachel Torr, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
So, Mary, I mentioned in the setup that your book, Between You and Me, is a kind of hybrid between a practical writing guide and a memoir. And so when you set out to write the book, did you think of it as trying to tell your story, or were you thinking it as, you know, a guide for people's writing, or was it always both?
I first conceived of it as something that grew out of my work at The New Yorker. My first name for it was Pencils and Punctuation. I thought I could just explore my obsession with pencils and the pieces I had written for NewYorker.com about oddities of New Yorker style were much more popular than I ever expected. So I thought I was writing something like a guide to New Yorker style, punctuated by pieces about pencils. And it turned into something kind of different, thanks to my editor. He was always encouraging me to broaden it out, because there's a good audience for The New Yorker. You know, it's a great magazine, but there's even a bigger audience that doesn't read The New Yorker. I guess that's what right. We were hoping to tap into.
So he encouraged you to add the more personal history and actual history of words and usage and things like that?
Yes, very much so. One of the examples, for instance, is the long discussion in the book about gender and pronouns.
Yeah.
And I go into detail about having had a brother who became my sister and having to learn how to use the right pronoun. And originally that section, which runs to four or five pages, I think, in the book, was a single sentence in parentheses. And it was my editor who said, oh, this is your whole story. Bring this out.
Well, I was going to say, it's also a really poignant part of the book because you talk about how you struggled and realized how you had hurt her by using the wrong pronoun. So it's really about, a lot of ways, about the power of language and getting it right and being respectful of what people want to be called.
I think maybe in even the few years since you've written this book, the singular they has sort of taken over as the preference for people who don't identify strongly with either male or female. So from an editorial and grammar standpoint, where do you stand on that particular issue?
Well, things are changing really fast. Even the language that applies to transgender people. When I wrote the first draft of the book, that was still transsexual. And by the time I was correcting the manuscript and the proofs, I had to change it to transgender and keep up with the politically correct words that... I think I had some initial resistance to it, but I got over it because of what you said, Rachel. I understood how strongly people felt about it. And you don't have to hurt people's feelings if you can just try to remember to use this other pronoun once in a while. I do still get a little tripped up sometimes on they. I recently read a book by the poet Eileen Miles, her book about her dogs, and her description on the back, I'm sorry, I should say their description on the back, used the singular they, they're going to find a new term for singular they. They're going to start calling it maybe singular they with some kind of gender inflection. It still confuses me because it's plural. And when I first get to it, I think, where's the other one? You know, or why is this here? And then you can adjust to it pretty quickly, though. I've seen it now used in The New Yorker. I think The New Yorker will sometimes go out of its way to make the subject of a piece comfortable and use the pronoun that the subject prefers.
Before we get too far into the weeds, I do want to hear a selection of the prose from your book, because in addition to being both really instructive and enjoyable to read, it's also really funny. And would you be willing to read a short selection from Between You and Me?
Sure. I think the hyphen chapter is the heart of this book. I thought it was going to be the commas, but it turned out to be the hyphen.
I want to say, I think the heart of the book is the narrator. And I think there are books that when you read them, you think, I want to be friends with this person. And that's how I felt when I read this book, because you kind of lay to rest that kind of, you know, witchy gotcha copy editor stereotype that I think for the most part isn't true, and bring an incredible warmth and humanity to the page that just, you know, that it's that we want to hear more. We want to hear more about the hyphen in Moby Dick. We want to hear more about pencils. We want to hear about, you know, who versus whom. And we want to hear more about you. And so I think that's really what makes this such a wonderful read.
So why don't we choose a section from the hyphen chapter then, which is titled, Who Put the Hyphen in Moby Dick?
What about these parts that involve the two women who were my mentors at The New Yorker?
Oh, sure, yeah.
When I was learning my way around on the copy desk, I noted the two schools of hyphenation. Eleanor Gould seemed to hyphenate everything, and Lou Burke hated anything extra. Maybe we should pause there to say that Eleanor Gould was this genius copy editor at The New Yorker, and nobody could really imitate her. You could learn as much as you could for her, but you couldn't have her brain. You just couldn't. And Lou was the cranky one. She actually threw a dictionary at somebody once. So Eleanor once mystified me by putting a hyphen in blue stained glass to make it blue stained glass. When I asked her about it, she took on an oracular look and allowed that it was a difficult concept. I had the impression that I would never grasp it. Is it stained glass that is blue, or glass that is blue stained? The answer would seem to be both. Eleanor was also a judicious withholder of hyphens. It was her judgment that a nuclear power plant did not call for a hyphen because it was both a power plant that happened to be nuclear and a plant that supplied nuclear power. There are other compounds that are not quite as double-jointed as nuclear power plants, but that still tempt people to put unnecessary hyphens in them. For example, high blood pressure. You can take it apart into high and blood pressure, that is, one can suffer from blood pressure that is high, but you cannot yoke together high blood and expect it to modify pressure. Someone might be tempted to hyphenate adult cable television, but what is an adult cable? You might refer to cable TV for adults as adult cable, but it's not the same thing. A phrase that teeters on the edge is bad hair day. Is a bad hair day like a Lou Burke day? That is what I say at the office when I am feeling especially irritable that I am having a Lou Burke day. Lou had her virtues, but she could be bad-tempered. When she was angry or frustrated for whatever reason, she would descend like a tornado on anyone who had the bad luck to be in her path. She reminded one of my colleagues of that cartoon Tasmanian devil, a spinning, whirling ball of fury that would bite anyone or anything that got in its way. It helped me to see this as comic. You could not take the behavior of a Tasmanian devil personally, and Lou's tirades were essentially harmless.
That was Mary Norris reading from her book, Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comic Queen. I love that section because it perfectly displays what we talked about, how it's this hybrid of memoir and usage guide. And you've both written, Rachel, you've written columns a lot about grammatical issues as well and your run-ins with them. And so how do you turn something that could be pretentious or dry into an entertaining read?
Well, I don't know anything about grammar, you know, so I always quote Joan Didion, who said, grammar is a piano I play by ear. Hmm. And there, I think all of us, we all have little things that drive us crazy. For me, the thing is, it's all about clarity. And one of the things that really interested me when I assigned Mary's book to my students is that some of the students read the book as, because Mary is such a graceful reader and has had the privilege of you know, reading the work of some of the best writers in the country, she gives a lot of credit to the writer and tries mm-hmm. to help them get what they want to do on the page. And it seems like a lot of times my students felt like you were giving them permission to care less about getting things right because you're not rigid. And often it was maybe the students who were perhaps the weakest with in terms of their skill controlling their sentences, who felt like you were giving them permission to not care.
Well, the main thing is I don't want people to feel afraid. I think the book was written a little bit in response to that Lynn Truss book.
Mm-hmm. You know, Eat, Shoots, and Leaves.
Eat, Shoots, and Leaves. I pretend to not remember the name of the book. Very funny, huh? But that she really does come on strong, you know, with fixing mm-hmm. vigilante copy mm-hmm. editing on sides of buses and things like that. And I notice the mistakes, you know, when a notice is put up in my elevator at home that says the laundry room is closed and it spells something wrong, I notice, but I don't get my pen out and fix it. You know? I'm not a harridan like that. And I want people to understand, too, that they don't have to be afraid, you know, to write an email. Right. And that there'll be a mistake in the email, and you certainly don't have to be afraid of things that you say. What I feel strongly about is when something is in print, you do your best to get it right. And an email is not, it's for publication in a sense, but it's not between covers, it's not formal. There is some stuff online that I would like to see raised to the quality of print and something between covers. But otherwise, I don't think it's something that we need to be rigid about. And anything, you know, that starts out as a mistake sometimes becomes standard usage. So you have to be careful about what you condemn. But I wanted to get back to something you said earlier about how you teach some of these things or how you get around to it in a book. And it's always to embed it in a story. It's always to try to embed the lesson in a story, just so that it goes down more easily and people can learn without feeling like they're being bludgeoned.
I mean, that, I think, is the real takeaway from your book, is that it is so enjoyable to read, but then you also learn a whole heck of a lot about the language. And that brings me nicely to your other sort of entertaining but instructive format, which was your popular Comic Queen videos on thenewyorker.com. So, you know, it strikes me that copy editors are very rarely ever sort of seen in public, and you only really notice their work if they do something wrong.
Right, right. You got that right.
So, how did the Comic Queen video series come forward, and how was it transitioning from, you know, sort of decades of behind the scene work to becoming a more a face on the New Yorker webpage?
Well, first of all, copy editing, I think, should be behind the scene work, and it was hard to come out from mm-hmm. behind the curtain. I wanted to be a writer, and copy editing was not my first choice of a subject. It just turned out to be what worked out for me, and it has worked out very well. And as far as the videos, that was in a time when The New Yorker was trying to have more presence online with videos, mm-hmm. you know, words on a page or on the screen are not enough. You've got to have a picture and a voice and somebody speaking and entertaining. So it was a hard, I avoided it for a long time because it was hard to work out how to do it. The hardest thing in making the videos was finding the examples. Naturally, I would gravitate toward things that were in the New Yorker, but my boss in the copy department, I think very reasonably, did not want me advertising our mistakes.
Sure.
So I had to find things. Maybe I'd found something in a galley that needed a fix, but that had appeared correctly in the magazine itself. Right. The other problem was the material. It couldn't touch on anything controversial. Mm. No racism, no sexism. So I had to find very bland examples. And for that reason, we limited the examples to about 3 per episode, and we kept the episodes very short.
I saw the Comma Queen had dropped off a couple of years ago, and that makes sense because you wrote a book and it's done very well, and it sounds like you have recently finished a new book that is coming out soon. Will you tell us about that?
Yes, I've written a book about Greek. This came out of some discussions I had with the editor of the first book. The first book had a lot of Greek in it that didn't make it all the way into the book because I'd been studying Greek while I was on the copy desk. I studied Greek for years and years, and it always informed my knowledge of English one way or another, either through grammar or through spelling. You know, we have a lot of words in English that come from the Greek. But anyway, because of all those things getting cut from the first book, it occurred to my editor when it was time to talk about a second book that I might want to write about Greek. And I would love to do that. I've made now 8 trips to Greece, and I've studied both modern Greek and ancient Greek. So we started experimenting with that. I started churning out material, and it was very hard to get in any kind of order, and that's something I'm not good at. I'm good at sentences and words, but I needed an editor to have an overall vision of what such a book would be.
That's one of my, when I worked in publishing and as an editor, one of the things that we used to say is that a book is as good for what's left out as for what remains. And then it's really hard to see it in your own work. So I have a question about what it was like for you to be copy edited.
Well, the first copy editor at Norton was a freelancer, and he was not afraid. However, I did feel he was a little competitive. You know, there were a few things he knew that I didn't know, and he stressed those. And I had to go look them up, and then I had to decide whether to take his advice or not. And
what was an example? Can you think of one?
If and whether, the difference between if and whether. I tend to use whether when I should be using if. Hmm. And, you know, the defense of all lazy writers is, well, it sounds better this way. So that's how I felt. It sounded better. I tried changing some things, some sentences, but they weren't my voice anymore after I'd made his changes. Mostly, though, he was fine. Then after that, an excerpt from the book ran in the New Yorker. So it had already been copy edited by Norton Style, and the New Yorker copy editors didn't know what to do. Do we change this back to New Yorker style? So they were afraid to touch it. And nobody could really relax around the copy editing of this book. And maybe as a result, maybe it just happens with everybody's books, there were mistakes in the book.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
My experience of copy editing has mostly been that it's a gift, and to have people point out your tics and your bad habits and just make you aware, and then get to decide whether or not you want to keep them. So were there any tics or things that you realized, like, oh yeah, like I need to actually not do that anymore?
One of the tics of a bad writer actually is automatically defensiveness and falling back on rhythm. But I like it. I like the rhythm of it this way. And
which
I don't
you
think
point
I
out in
that.
The book that is, you disregard that unless the writer is a poet.
Yes.
Which I love.
I don't scan the prose. Thank you. So for me, you know, I've always admired writers. Those are the best writers. They're always they want to be copy edited. They appreciate what you find and what you do. And I wanted to belong to that segment of the writing population. So I won't say I accepted everything, but I wanted to be open to everything. And I really did make an effort to be open to everything that anyone suggested, which you can tell by the language was hard for me. I really tried to make an effort to be open.
But my guest has been Mary Norris, author of Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comma Queen, and Rachel Tor, who teaches at Eastern Washington University and invited Mary as part of the Eastern Washington Visiting Writers series. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Chris. And thank you, Rachel. I love it here.